My guest Greg Mankiw is one of the economists who's skeptical of President-elect Obama's proposed economic stimulus package. Unlike our previous guest, Dean Baker, who says that Obama should be spending even more to revive the economy, Mankiw says there are ample reasons to doubt whether an increase in government spending is what the economy needs. Mankiw is an economics professor at Harvard and was a chair of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisers. He was also an economic advisor to Mitt Romney during his presidential primary campaign. Greg Mankiw, welcome to Fresh Air. I know you have some serious doubts about whether a huge increase in government spending is what the government really needs. What are some of your doubts?
Well, there's no question that the economy right now is suffering through a very difficult time and that we need to do something to get the economy back on track. And the question is, what is that? If any economist tells you they know exactly what we need to do and they're absolutely sure, you shouldn't trust them, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty and we're in very much an uncharted water here. So everybody's taking their best guess. Now, the Obama administration is proposing a very large increase in government spending. And in some sense, that's very much the textbook solution to an economic downturn. And I say that literally. If you look in most economics textbooks, including my own, you'll see that one way to prop up an economy is to increase government spending, increase aggregate demand for goods and services, and thereby increase employment. The question is, and I think economists disagree on this, the question is that theory actual truth, or is it an hypothesis? And I think one can make the argument that we're not really very sure, and therefore one should be wary about massive increases in government spending at this time.
On the other hand, I mean, what Obama is trying to do with the stimulus program in part is to create jobs and at the same time have those jobs be related to things we really need, like improving the infrastructure, becoming more, environmental in terms of like having green buildings. There are serious things that need to be done, and including electronic medical records. So if we can kill two birds with one stone here, if we could like boost the economy and create jobs while at the same time improving our infrastructure, you could argue what's not to like. So let me ask you, what's not to like?
Well, I think you put your finger on the right question, which is, are we going to spend the money on things we really need? And in particular, do the projects we're going to undertake pass a basic cost-benefit test, where the money we spend on it is going to exceed the money we're going to lay out? But traditional Keynesian theory suggests that even if you just spend the money on unnecessary things, that's good for priming the pump and getting the economy going. If we hire people to dig holes and fill them up again, at least that's creating jobs, that's creating income. They'll go and spend that, and that'll help expand the economy through the multiplier effect. I don't think most economists today would go quite that far, and they think we should actually spend it on things we need. The question is, can you find hundreds of billions of dollars of things we need very quickly? Let me give you a very concrete example based on my own hometown. I live in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and we're just about to start a project to build a new high school. And I've actually been tangentially involved in that, writing some op-eds in favor of spending the money to build a new high school. Well, it took years for the town of Wellesley to come to that conclusion. There was a lot of debate as to whether we should build a new high school or renovate the old high school, how much we should spend in the new high school, what was necessary in the new high school, what wasn't necessary in the new high school. There's a lot of debate within the town, eventually a town referendum, to decide on how we should spend our money. Well, now move that kind of decision up from the local level where people are directly affected up to the federal level, and then multiply it by many thousands of projects, not just one project, and then say we're going to do this all very quickly, not over the course of years, but we're going to do it within a course of just a few weeks. And you wonder, gee, are we really going to make the right decisions? And that is one of my skepticisms about very quick increases in government spending, which is that we might not have done the necessary cost-benefit analysis to make sure we're getting our money's worth.
What about if we took more time and deliberated and did cost-benefit analyses and stuff? Would there be problems then?
Well, that's the rub. The economy needs a solution right now. And if we take our time and take the years it takes to really do the cost-benefit analysis right, the stimulus will be too late. The projects may still be worth doing. We'll know they're worth doing. But in terms of the short-run stimulus of creating jobs, it won't have that effect, which is something we need done in a matter of months and not years.
So given your concerns about this kind of like rapid spending program, what are the alternatives that you see?
Well, there are a variety of tools that the federal government has to get the economy going again. If you open the textbooks, they talk first about monetary policy versus fiscal policy. Monetary policy is what the Federal Reserve does. It expands or contracts the money supply, which in turn affects interest rates and a variety of other asset prices. Fiscal policy is what the Congress does. And fiscal policy has two parts. It has spending, but also has taxes. And so if one is skeptical about spending, as I am, then you could ask, okay, what can monetary policy do and what can tax policy do? And now there's yet another tool that they've been using lately, which is financial policy of recapitalizing the banks through this TARP program that the Treasury has been implementing. So there are a variety of other tools out there, and I would rather see more emphasis on these other tools and less emphasis on the spending.
Obama has warned that we face trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. How concerned are you about those deficits?
Well, in the longer term, I'm very concerned. I mean, it's a standard view among economists that short-run deficits are not a problem when you're dealing with a short-run business cycle. But in the longer term, we have to think about the government budget constraint, and we have to think about the burden we're placing on future generations. The longer-term problem facing the United States is that we have programs, some of which established during the New Deal, that will become increasingly costly as the baby boom generation retires and as we become older as a society. And in particular, I'm speaking about Social Security and the sister program, Medicare, and also Medicaid to some degree to the extent that it serves an elderly population. Those programs are going to increase in cost over time as we have more and more elderly as a fraction of the population. We do not have the wherewithal at this point to pay for them in the sense that the gap between projected spending and projected tax revenue just is going to grow bigger and bigger and bigger over time. And so the question is, what do we do about that? And I don't think we have a simple answer, but that is one of the great challenges that this president and future presidents are going to have to grapple with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Greg Mankiw, and he's a professor of economics at Harvard. He was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bush. He was one of the chairs. Since most of us, many of us, are paying such careful attention to economics now because we feel so much that our fate is in the hands of economists, I'm wondering what it was like inside the Council of Economic Advisors. Like, what does the council do?
Yeah, the Council of Economic Advisors is a group of professional economists working inside the White House complex. The council itself is only three members, a chairman and two other members who are appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. But then there's also a staff of about 30 or 35 who come in usually to work for a year or two. There's some longer-term staffers, but most of them are temporary staffers. They're typically economists from universities, economists from other parts of government who are coming to work for the president just for a short period of time in order to essentially be an in-house think tank for the White House.
So what was one of the toughest decisions you were consulted on?
Well, I think when I got there, the economy was suffering through the last recession or in the tail ends of that. The economy was just starting the recovery. It was the very beginning of 2003 when I arrived. And we were then contemplating what the next tax bill would look like in order to get the economy back on the road to recovery. I think we did succeed in getting a tax bill through, and I think that did help the recovery. I think that there's still debate about the various pieces of that. Parts of that Barack Obama is going to keep. Parts of it he's not. From my perspective of what a good tax system looked like, I thought that took us a step in the right direction toward a better tax system.
I'm not trying here to hold you responsible for the for the mortgage crisis, but do you feel at all that you and other economic advisors within the Bush administration failed to sound the alarm that we were living in a bubble and that the bubble would burst?
One of the things I was involved with when I was down there was an attempt to reform the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we recognized that those were ticking time bombs. I don't think we appreciated they would blow up quite as quickly as they did. But we understood that the whole structure of those institutions was not healthy for the economy. Interestingly, I don't think that was a Republican versus Democratic issue. When I was started working on that issue there, one of the things I did is I called one of my friends who had previously worked in a pretty high level in the Clinton administration, And I asked him what his analysis of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was. And it turned out it was almost the same as ours. Our fears about Fannie and Freddie and our attempts at trying to get reform in that part of the economy was very similar to what the Clinton economists wanted. In both cases, we were stymied by political forces. So I think the distinction there wasn't so much between Republicans and Democrats, but rather between the policy wonks and the political pressures in Congress that really didn't want reform of Fannie and Freddie. And part of that was that Fannie and Freddie were very powerful institutions politically, but part of it was sort of a worldview in both parties that home ownership should be promoted at all costs. And that, looking back, that was probably a mistake.
When you look at the people who Barack Obama has chosen as his economic team, what do you expect his actions will be based on the track record of his choices in advising?
Oh, Barack Obama has made some great choices for economic advisors. I'm actually very close to many of them, just coincidentally. Larry Summers was one of my mentors. He was one of my professors when I was a grad student at MIT and one of my colleagues at Harvard. And I worked with him for a year in 82, 83 when we both worked on the staff of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Reagan administration. Christina Romer was a friend of mine in grad school. I was an old friend of her husband's. In fact, I was best man at her wedding, and her husband was best man at mine. So Christy and I have been longtime friends. And Jason Furman, who I believe is Larry Summers' deputy at the National Economic Council, was a student of mine at Harvard. So I know these people very well, and they're very, very competent, very mainstream economists who are going to make sensible decisions, not necessarily always the same judgments that I would make in those circumstances, but they will make sensible judgment calls.
So you have faith that they're going to be smart and make smart decisions, even whether you agree with those decisions or not?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, so for example, I'm completely confident that they're all free traders. Now, Barack Obama gave sort of mixed messages about trade during the campaign. It makes me very nervous about him. His track record as a senator was very anti-trade, if you look at his voting record. His discussion of wanting to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement during the campaign made me very nervous, as did many economists. But the economists he's choosing to advise him are not skeptics about trade at all. They're very much free traders. So I have no doubt in their judgment. Whether the political process will let their voices speak is another question.
You've served in government, chairing the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bush, and you're at Harvard now. You're a professor of economics. You've written economics textbooks, two of which are, I understand, very popular. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between seeing the economy through the lens of somebody serving the president and seeing the economy through the outside academic world?
Well, there are pluses and minuses of both jobs. The great thing about being chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors is you have access to data sources and staff that a professor does not have. So as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, you get the next day's news the evening before. So all the economic statistics that the government reports are given to the CEA chair the evening before, so he gets to see what's about to be released. He writes a memo to the president, which then gets distributed to a few other people, such as the Federal Reserve Chair and Secretary of Treasury. And you have a huge staff to help you interpret anything you don't understand. So if there's any minor statistic that I never heard of or didn't know how to interpret, I had a great staff that could tell me how to make sense of it. And in terms of a learning experience, for me, it was fantastic. I just learned a lot about how the economy works and had a great experience both working with the people in the White House and working with a really terrific staff at the Council. The nice thing about being a professor at Harvard is you have complete freedom. You get to say whatever you want to say, whenever you want to say it. Here I am talking to you, expressing my views. I don't feel like I'm a part of a team, therefore representing the President of the United States. Whereas when you're chairman of the council, you're representing the president, and people are more interested in the president's views than your views. And so you're there a little bit like a lawyer representing a client. You're obviously talking truthfully about how you think the economy is, but you're also representing a point of view made by a team within an administration and not as a singleton.
I don't know if you'll feel comfortable answering this, but did you ever feel like you were called on to justify a position as opposed to give an independent analysis of a position, you know, of an approach?
Well, there's two sort of environments where you operate when you're chairman of the council. What is the public environment and the private environment? In private, where you're with the president and his team, you have to be completely blunt. It's the job of an economic advisor to tell the president exactly what they think, even if the president doesn't want to hear it. And I remember sitting in meetings saying, you know, Mr. President, I think you're just wrong about that. And President Bush is completely fine about that. He actually wants people to disagree with him when they do and to hear their point of view frankly. And I never had any trouble in private meetings saying exactly what I think whenever I thought it. And part of it was I had a tenured job waiting for me at Harvard. It made it a little easier, perhaps. but no, privately, it was very easy to express my views. In public forums, the situation is very different. Because when you go out in public, give a public speech, you're there as a representative of the president. And no White House can function when every person working for the president can go out in public and spell out in detail every specific time they disagree with some specific decision the president makes. So you have to recognize that in public, you're there as a representative of the person who's elected. You have to remind yourself that you weren't elected anything. The president was elected. You were just appointed by the president, and therefore you have to serve his views and his interests as well as the national interests.
Would it be violating the code of discretion for you to tell us about one of the decisions or positions in which you seriously differed from the president and yet had to publicly discuss it in a way that defended it?
Well, I never felt like I was defending points of view that I didn't have. I wasn't ever saying, I think this is a good idea. I would always say the president thinks this, and this is why the president thinks this. You know, the president always makes decisions. Oh, no, this is true of all presidents for good reasons. All decisions have pros and cons, and sometimes it's a matter of coming down of weighing the pros and cons. And what we did as economic advisors was to explain to the president what the pros of a policy are, what the cons of a policy are. And ultimately, he's going to have to weigh the pros and cons and decide what the judgment call is. So I never felt uncomfortable defending the president's policies, even if in the end of the day, I might have weighed the pros and cons a little differently than he did.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Greg Mankiw is an economics professor at Harvard. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.